You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
It's a great pleasure to welcome Albie Sachs to the Open Society Institute, and also a great pleasure to welcome Jack Greenberg, who will comment or respond to Albie Sachs's remarks. I'm Arye Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Institute, and we are assembled to mark the publication of Albie Sachs's latest book, The Strange Alchemy of Life and Law. I think probably most of you know quite a lot about Albie Sachs, so forgive me for repeating what you know. But he was a longtime advocate for equal rights in South Africa, who was punished for his involvement in the rights struggle in South Africa by the apartheid regime, and then forced into exile. And even in exile, they were intent on harming him. And in exile in Mozambique, he was the victim of a car bombing arranged by the South African police, in which he lost an arm and he lost the sight in one eye. Albie Sachs nevertheless has managed to continue his work on behalf of rights. And when Nelson Mandela was elected president of South Africa in 1994, he appointed Albie Sachs to the Constitutional Court in South Africa. And with Albie Sachs on that court and other distinguished members of that court, the Constitutional Court in South Africa became one of the foremost judicial bodies in the world in terms of the significance and the quality of its jurisprudence. And Albie Sachs dealt with a large number of cases involving rights in which the South African court has led the way worldwide in enhancing the rights of the citizens of its country. To comment on Albie Sachs's remarks, I think we have the person in the United States best qualified to do so. Jack Greenberg, as I think most of you know, has been one of the giants of the effort to promote rights within this country. He was one of the lawyers who brought the case of Brown versus Board of Education to the United States Supreme Court, decided by the court in 1954. Some years after that, when Thurgood Marshall left his post as the director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, he chose Jack Greenberg to be his successor as the director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. In that capacity, he both led the organization from the standpoint of running it, but he also was a leading advocate on behalf of the organization in the courts, and argued some 40 cases in the United States Supreme Court. since stepping down from his post at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, Jack Greenberg has been with Columbia University, serving as at various times as deputy dean of the law school and as dean of Columbia College, and also today as a professor of law at Columbia University. I'm glad to say that the that OSI has been associated with Jack Greenberg's work in recent times, because having been a leader, or perhaps the leader, of the effort to challenge segregation in the United States, he has focused in recent times on segregation of the Roma in Eastern Europe, and has traveled in Eastern Europe, and I understand is about to publish in the Columbia Law Review about the Roma in Eastern Europe. So, Albi, we're delighted to have you here.
Do you want to be clear? I was 39, quietly teaching law at the University of Southampton, living in exile, when I discovered I was a terrorist. The knowledge came to me when I sought to enter the United States of America to attend a conference at Yale University on contemporary Southern African politics and history. And because I was a member of the ANC, with such well-known terrorists as Nelson Mandela in its leadership, I was automatically a terrorist. As it turned out, the lobby group in Washington that was campaigning against apartheid managed to get the edge over the lobby group in Washington supporting the regime in South Africa. So I discovered I was no longer a terrorist, and I was able to come. I felt, as we all did, great indignation at that label. To be called a terrorist in South Africa wasn't just something unseemly and a negative appellation. It had consequences, and serious consequences. Thousands of us were detained without trial. And once you have detention without trial, it opens the way to torture, to violations of every kind. And then instead of the courts being the bodies that decide on guilt or innocence, it's the people in charge of the security apparatus who decide, with maybe a court at the end having some kind of final word. And being a practicing advocate at the Cape Town Bar didn't give me any immunity from these processes. And one day, it was the beginning of our spring, I was still wearing quite a heavy suit, I'm entering the chambers where the advocates practiced near the High Court in Cape Town. Suddenly, police emerged, like you see in the movies, somebody reading a newspaper, somebody behind a pillar, all very inert, and they pounce. And within a short while, I'm in a concrete cube. No access to lawyers, to family, to anybody. I don't know how long I'm going to be detained. It's called the 90-day law. People of a certain rank in the police force can lock up, detain, incommunicado, any person whom they believe might have information that could be relevant to questions of terrorism and campaigning using violence against the state. I'm sitting in this cube. I stare at my toes. I stare at the wall. My toes, the wall, my toes, eager for time to pass. It's 5 minutes. It's 10 minutes. I stare. There's no one to speak to, there's nothing to do, there's no activity. I don't know how long it's going to be. And that same encapsulation in nothingness, without people, without dialogue, without interaction, without humanity, goes on and on and on. I try to invent activities to remind myself of myself as a living person with some autonomy and choice and individual authority. I remember going through the states of the United States of America. Wasn't quite sure. I knew it was about 50, 48, 49. And I'll start with Alabama. To myself, I didn't say Arkansas, Arkansas. Working my way through the A's and the B's. But I can't write the names down. And I'm trying to remember, I had two arms then, so at least I could get up to 10 fingers. And then I would go through songs, always, starting with A. Because, Charmaine, anybody who wants to know what some of the hit tunes of October 1963 were, just has to press the button for me to recall. I had problems with X, so I cheated a little bit deep in the heart of Texas. That's the best I could do. But my favorite was always, I'll be living here, always, year after year, always, in this little cell that I know so well, I'll be living swell, always, always. And then I would twirl around a little bit and kind of feel amused that the upper class manners of Noel Coward, taken from an Irving Berlin tune, were keeping this young freedom fighter in South Africa in good spirits. I'll be staying in, always, keeping up my chin, always, not for but an hour, not for but a week, not for 90 days, but always. And that was became like my theme song. 90 days passed, I'm told, get ready to go, you're being released. They give me back my tie. It's now midsummer, they give me back that heavy summer suit that I had, my watch that I hadn't had all this time. I go down the stairs from that little cell. Station commander is beaming. I'm suspicious. Are you really releasing me? Yes, he said. I walk out. I see one of the interrogators coming towards me from the street. He puts out his hand. I think that's nice. And he says, I'm placing you under arrest. I take my watch, my tie, I go back to the cell again. All done in terms of the law. You can be detained for 90 days, and then another 90 days, another 90 days. Eventually, after 168 days, I was released. I never knew why I was detained. To this day, I don't know. Never knew why I was released. I was so overjoyed, I ran from the center of Cape Town, right through Cape Town, past Greenpoint, Sea Point, for anybody who knows that area, to Clifton, about 10 miles away. Flung myself clothed into the sea. 2 years later, I was back inside again. And this time, the treatment was harsher. A team had come down from Johannesburg, led by the famous, notorious Rooirus Swanepoel. And they would bang the table for 10 minutes, making a heavy din, and then 50 minutes total silence. And they worked in relays through the afternoon, through the evening, through the night. I was given something to eat at one stage. I saw them smirking and I realized afterwards there was something in that food. And we discovered afterwards they used means of medication to weaken their will. And the early hours of the morning come and I can feel myself getting weaker. And I've heard of people who held out for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, wonderfully, on the fourth day they broke, and they broke completely. They lost all control. So I decide to try and manage my breakdown. My mind is fighting my body. My body is getting stronger and stronger, just determined to get some sleep, some rest. I collapse on the floor. Suddenly they all come pouring in. I see these shoes, brown shoes and black shoes. Lots of agitation. I hear the voices above me. Water pours on me. I'm lifted up. I close my eyes. Rooirus himself with his thick fingers pushes my eyes open. I sit for a while, I collapse again. It happened a few times. It's the worst moment of my life by far. Far worse than the bomb. The attack on my will and my consciousness, my sense of self. The bomb hit my body and it wasn't nice, but it was relatively easy to recover from that. And after 3 months, I'm released. This time, my colleagues wondered, what was I going to do now? I ran to the sea last time. I said, no, just take me home. it was a defeat, a moral defeat. It was personally humiliating. And I can recall it was during the first detention that I took a vow that if ever, ever, ever I'm in authority or power, I would never do this. I'd use what authority I've got to prevent this kind of thing from happening to another human being. It's partly a fantasy you have when you're totally disempowered. You like to imagine yourself in power. It's just a form of self-elevation, if you like. But it was a vow that I made to myself, just quietly. So being called a terrorist then, as I said, had consequences. And thousands of others had much worse treatment, and many were tortured to death. And that label was used to justify the means, the destruction of the rule of law as it existed before, and to almost give a sense of virtue to what was being done, because we are combating terrorism. We are not dealing with human beings. We are not concerned with human dignity. We are concerned with protecting our society, then it was an apartheid society, from terrorists. What made it particularly paradoxical was the ANC had taken a strong stand against terrorism. This was the period of isms, how do you all remember, apart from socialism, communism, capitalism, Maoism, there were lots of isms all over the place. And one of the isms that we combated inside the ANC was terrorism. If somebody was called inside the organization as advancing terrorism, then that would be seen as a bad mark. It destroyed your argument because we were against terrorism. And there were strong reasons for that. It wasn't simply that at a time when the Black September movement was hijacking planes, getting huge headlines, and young members of the ANC were saying, what's the matter with the ANC leadership? Why don't we do this? Then people will take notice of our cause. It wasn't simply that if we did that, we would be playing into the hands of those who said we were simply terrorists and not people who would build a new society in South Africa. That the tussle was simply one of power, you would be in control. Oliver Tambo, ANC leader in exile, had the strong feeling not only that maybe he or decent people would be on the planes that could be subjected to this destruction. It was a more profound thing. When you go in for indiscriminate actions like that, it's not only what you do to people who are affected, it's what you do to yourself. You become an instrument of death. And we're fighting for life. We're fighting for respect, for human dignity. And you are closing down all the aspects of your own personality and the things that give your movement a certain fervor and cohesion and vitality and memorability, all those things are being excluded. You simply become an instrument. And you can rebuild buildings that are blown up and get the farms going. But the minute a racial war starts, the psychological, emotional damage becomes so pervasive, so powerful, that you never get a country. And our dream was to get a country. So terrorism, in that sense, was aiming to destroy everything that we wanted to achieve, simply for the purpose of expressing your anger and destroying those in power. We had a conference in Kabwe, 1985, a little town in Zambia, surrounded by Zambian troops in case commandos came to take out all the leaders of the ANC in exile, maybe a few underground people who were there. And two items on the agenda I remember very specifically were related to terrorism and torture. A King Sabata Dalindyebo, we called him Comrade King, he'd been forced out of the country by Pretoria because he wasn't compliant, he was patriotic, spoke at the conference and he told a story. And he used the African language, Xhosa, and at the end, everybody laughed, except the few of us who were culturally backward, didn't understand the language. We had to wait for the translation, and then we laughed. And the story was of two men who were fighting with sticks, violently, and their wives were urging them on, each one. And the wife of man A said, my husband You are stronger than B. Everybody knows that. You can defeat him easily. But he is beating you up. Why? Because you are wielding a stick in one hand and you are holding a blanket in your other hand to hide your nakedness. Drop the damn blanket and beat him up, smash him up. And that's when people laughed. And when we heard the translation, that's when we laughed. And it was really saying, why does the ANC impose these restraints on itself? Now, I would have jumped up and given an ideological response about the long-standing traditions and policies of the organization. But there was what I call an African way of responding. You hear him out. He's a king. He doesn't know too much about politics. He's not steeped in the traditions of the organization. The people just laughed nicely, quietly. We've heard you, Comrade King. We listen to what you're saying, but that's not our policy. And they just moved on. It was an indirect reaffirmation of no terrorism. The second hot item on the agenda was whether or not intensive methods of interrogation could be used against spies and agents sent in by Pretoria to destroy the ANC. This was something very, very real. I don't have to wave my arm to show that these were not just dealing with dissidents who disagreed politically. It turned out that the ANC leadership had received a report that, in fact, these captives were being grossly ill-treated by ANC security. When Oliver Tambo asked me to help with the code of conduct, he said it must be very difficult. He said, we are a political organization. We don't have regulations about what to do with captives. I assume the Democratic Party doesn't have regulations about what to do with captive enemies. They might wish to have it, but they don't have it. We weren't a state in exile. We were people surviving and then trying to bring the fight back to South Africa. He said it must be very difficult to draft regulations. I said, in a rather confident, lawyer-like way, it's not so difficult. We've got international instruments that say no torture, inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. He said, we use torture. His face was bleak. We use torture. I was stunned. We're fighting for freedom and we use torture. He didn't explain the circumstances, but he asked me to help draft what turned out to be a code, really a criminal law code and a code of criminal procedure for a liberation movement in exile. And it had significant outcomes. The personnel in charge of security were changed. People, if they were detained, had to have a charge put to them. A case had to be brought against them. We established tribunals. We established defense counsel, rights of appeal, appropriate punishments, and so on. It didn't stop the ill-treatment completely, but it completely transformed the situation where we're fighting a ruthless enemy. They have no standards at all. We've got to be tough and ruthless against them. It was saying we are a freedom-fighting organization with the morale and standards and ethic, and that must apply to everything that we do. The question now at the conference was, accepting the code of conduct, everybody agreed, should intensive methods of interrogation be permitted in circumstances of necessity? And I still remember the young ANC soldiers, we never knew what their real names were, going up onto the platform, and one after the other saying no. And the one young guy said, he used that phrase, we are fighting for life. How can we be disrespectful of life? I was so moved. It was so easy for me, a lawyer, relatively privileged, to say these are our standards, we learn. These were people in the front line, facing death, facing torture themselves. And I could see what was animating them. When you're fighting for an ideal, it's got to run all the way through. And that's what gives you that cohesion, that cement, that sense of togetherness that enables you to withstand terrible privations and to see things through. Terrorism. I was never myself in the armed struggle. I supported it in South Africa, given the fact that people were disenfranchised, the organizations were banned, attempts at having national conferences were completely repudiated. And without some element of fighting back like that, provided it didn't become the total picture and was always part and parcel of an international campaign and public mobilization inside the country to get to a position where we could negotiate a new setup as soon as possible, provided that happened, I supported it. I'm as close to being a pacifist as you can get without being a pacifist. If you're a true pacifist, you don't make exceptions. I made exceptions in the case of South Africa. But I never picked up a gun myself. Terrorism came to me. The armed struggle came to me. And you've heard from Ari a little bit about the bomb being placed in the car. And people often in these discussions forget that more people in the world have died through state terrorism, certainly in my lifetime, than through the violence of irregular groups aiming at civilian populations. You just have to think of Chile and Argentina and the wanton use of state power in civil war situations in Africa and in Asia and elsewhere to realize that position. The final phase of my presentation, we fast forward. I'm a judge wearing the green gown of the Constitutional Court. And we're hearing cases under the new Constitution dealing with terrorism and torture. One of the themes of the book is to what extent do those experiences which I've described enter into the decisions I make now, not as Albie Sachs, not as Albie Sachs, one-time member of the ANC, not as Albie Sachs, professor of law, Sachs J. Albie Sachs, justice of the Constitutional Court, who has sworn an oath to do justice to all without fear, favor, or prejudice. What is justice? Who are the all? We had the case of Dr. Basson, who'd been charged with, not been charged, it was acknowledged as head of South Africa's bacteriological chemical warfare program in the late apartheid era. The charges against him included using his medical skills to give injections to about 200 militants from the captive militants from the SWAPO, Southwest African People's Organization, who then are rendered semi-conscious, according to the evidence, taken in little planes over the sea and dropped. So it's a way of killing and disposing of the body, taken, I believe, from Argentina, where this was done quite extensively. You die and you disappear. Horrendous. I won't go through all the technical permutations, but in the end, the trial judge hearing the matter said, we can't try him in a South African court for a conspiracy to commit an offense in another country. How do we respond to someone like that? Do we bend the law because of the horror of what he's done? If we do that, what are we fighting for? We're fighting for the rule of law, for constitutionalism. But is the Constitution silent in relation to matters like that? And so we introduce the themes of the war crimes, prosecutions not being restricted to events that take place necessarily within your territory, and a whole range of other questions like that have to be brought into play. And I'm thinking about Dr. Basson, and I write strongly, because we're dealing with a technical aspect of the state, why the matter should go to trial and not be struck quashed in the way that the High Court had done, citing international law and South African domestic law experience for that. But the judgment I write ends with the comment that the sheer gravity of the crimes with which he's being charged is not a reason for relaxing the legal principles at stake. If anything, it becomes even more important when you're dealing with people who allege to have challenged the very character and nature of the legal system under which they are trying to assert rights, to assert the integrity of that system, to show the gap between what they're trying to achieve, the manner they're trying to achieve, and what we stand for. It becomes more important, not less important, to maintain these particular principles. We had a case of, it was called Kaunda. Extraordinary. We were recalled from our recess. 65 South African mercenaries in a plane that had landed in Harare. There'd been a tip-off. They were arrested, apparently on their way to Equatorial Guinea to overthrow, kill the president of Equatorial Guinea. The case got some international interest when Margaret Thatcher's son, Mark Thatcher, got named. Then it became an interesting case for the media. And what made it so poignant was the families, the brothers, the sisters, the mothers, the children of the mercenaries came rushing to the Constitutional Court. So here's a group of people. You can't be more lawless than to be a mercenary going to kill in another country. It's not even fighting for regime change in your own country, and you're doing it for money. You couldn't violate more principles of law than that. And they're invoking the Bill of Rights. They say we have a Bill of Rights in South Africa. We must protect them from being tortured in Zimbabwe and from being sent to Equatorial Guinea, being executed without having a fair trial. It was quite a tricky case, and we had to give an answer quickly. There was no point in writing a beautiful posthumous judgment. And we decided we couldn't apply the South African Bill of Rights to people living in another country. That's an invasion of the sovereignty of another country. But we could say that as South African citizens, the state owed them a certain measure of protection. Not general diplomatic protection. International law hasn't moved that far. Where you have a right to diplomatic protection if you are locked up in any other country. You have a right of consular access, that's all. And we held in the end with various different judgments that to the extent that there are certain principles of obligatory customary international law that operate, they form part of our constitution. And it meant that our foreign affairs people were under a duty to use what efforts they could to save South African citizens abroad from being subjected to torture and subjected to punishment without a fair trial. That's in customary international law. We would have liked to have said customary international law prohibited capital punishment, but it hadn't reached that stage. It hasn't reached that stage. And as long as the United States of America still practices it, it's difficult to make out a case for saying it's reached the stage where capital punishment violates customary international law. It was a small symbolical gesture in the keeping with certain principles that we felt were fundamental to our whole new constitutional order. The last case I'll mention is Mr. Mohammed, who, after it all turned out, the evidence came out afterwards, helping to transport the bomb in Dar es Salaam that blew up the embassy and killed maybe 20 Americans and about 40 Tanzanians, came to Cape Town, worked as a pastry chef, very, very quietly under an assumed name. The FBI knew he was there. They didn't know under which name. They had his photograph. They were waiting. They caught him. The South African immigration authorities were very excited to be working with the FBI. And the next thing anyone knew, he was in a plane off to New York to stand trial and face the death sentence. There was no question about the fact that he deserved to be extradited and put on trial. This was a horrible, grotesque form of misconduct that had to be dealt with by the law. But our court, in its judgment, took a very strong stand in relation to two aspects. First of all, he'd been denied access to counsel. And we said the more serious the offense, the greater the need for people in making their choices, whether to go to bring proceedings or whatever to do, to have counsel. And secondly, we said our court had declared that capital punishment violated the principles of our Bill of Rights. And so to send somebody to a country where that person might be executed is like sending somebody to a country where they might be tortured. Our officials had no right to do that. They should have gotten assurance first that if found guilty, he would not be executed. And that assurance was given to German authorities. who surrendered another part of that particular group, they got that assurance. And we felt, or no, I can't say we felt, I felt that in the case of Germany, they use extradition. In the case of South Africa, it was rendition. I saw that word for the first time. We're just that little African country down there. These questions of international law aren't all that important. We couldn't send a gunboat to get him back. All we could do was to send a copy of the judgment to the trial judge, hoping that he would make it available to the jury. But we were telling South African officials, you don't hand someone over in those circumstances. Now, what's interesting from the point of view of the theme in my book is that Laurie Ackerman, my colleague, who collected wine labels, whose passion and commitment to the Constitution came from his Christian beliefs. His wife was a professor of theology. He was a great devotee of Immanuel Kant. He's just brought out a book on human dignity. His life experience, professional experience, completely different from mine. And I can go through all 11 judges. We were unanimous on this. So it's not as though life experience predicts an outcome. It gives you a vision of the world, of things that matter. It underlines certain themes. And then in the debate on the court, you'll all interact with each other. And I mention this because of the debate about whether a wise Latina woman has something special to contribute to constitutional justice. And as far as I'm concerned, I think all my colleagues are concerned, it's absolutely obvious that she would. It doesn't mean she's the only person who can. It's important that she's wise. But the experience of growing up as a woman in a particular setting, belonging to a particular community, speaking a particular language, can only enrich the sensibility and the understanding of the court. And so the theme of the book is the strange alchemy of life and law. The alchemy is there whether you like it or not. It's strange because often the consequences can't be easily predicted. There are lots of surprises. And there's a certain rigor and control that the law itself has. I had immense joy and pleasure writing it as a Ford Foundation scholar in residence with Capitals last year. And I'm enjoying enormously taking it around to the United States. And I'm particularly pleased to be on the platform with Aria, whom I met in South Africa, whose work I've admired very much. I don't even know what your life experiences have been, but I know that we have similar philosophies on a whole range of things. I was even the person who got the word open into our constitution, or for what that's worth. And to be with Jack Greenberg, who's been a tremendous friend and colleague, and I know quite a lot about Jack's life experiences, and I'm sure they influenced his thinking, but he's not a judge. But if he were a judge, I'm sure it would work out in the same way. And thank you all for being here.
Thank you very much. Jack Greenberg?
Well, I'll speak only briefly. Albie was talking about connections, and I'll mention here another connection between one freedom struggle and another, and that is in 1961, the Freedom Riders descended upon Mississippi. Freedom Riders, I think perhaps everyone here knows, were American citizens, though citizens of other countries as well, who defied the laws of apartheid in the United States in those days, which required, among its various other strictures, that when riding on a bus, blacks would sit in the back and whites would sit in the front. And so black and white freedom riders got on these buses and blacks sat in the front and whites sat in the back. And as they arrived in Mississippi, they were all arrested, 400 of them in this particular demonstration, one right after another over a period of days, taken before a justice of the peace, immediately sentenced to 6 months in Parchman Prison, which is a prison in Mississippi that housed the most violent and egregious lawbreakers. And the legal defense, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, which I headed at the time, went about trying to free them. They were entitled to an appeal. And we took their appeals into the federal courts and ultimately won all 400 cases in the Supreme Court of the United States. Among the lawyers defending the Freedom Riders were, for the first time, a large influx of white lawyers from the North who had never been in civil rights before, and they came down and they worked with the Legal Defense Fund representing all these 400 defendants. Among them was a young lawyer called David Hood, who later on went on to become dean of the University of Hawaii Law School and then went to work for the Carnegie Corporation. Carnegie Corporation at that time had a program called the Commonwealth Program. And while South Africa no longer was in the Commonwealth, with some sort of a judicial interpretation, they interpreted that to mean include former members of the Commonwealth. And in that connection, David Hood thought that South Africa could profit by having something like the NAACP Legal Defense Fund functioning within that country. And so he proposed that to Carnegie, visited South Africa, and they decided to try to get something like that started. Because of David Hood's involvement with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, he asked me to go, and my wife Debbie's here in the audience too, go to South Africa, meet with South African lawyers, tell them about the practice of public interest law in the United States, and see what we could do to help launch something like the Legal Defense Fund in South Africa. And we went, out of that grew something called the Legal Resources Center, which made a substantial contribution towards the end of apartheid in South Africa. While I was there, I felt I should meet not only with South African lawyers within South Africa, but I should meet with Albie Sachs, of whom I'd heard. And he was then in exile in Mozambique after the experiences, some of which he described to you. So I called the American Embassy in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, and asked, did they know how I could get in touch with Albie Sachs? Well, they knew exactly where he was. They arranged an appointment, and Debbie and I flew up there to meet with him. And I still recall Albie's first words to me were, why are you meeting with the enemies of my people? He wasn't confrontational, but that was confrontational enough. I explained what I was doing. He was skeptical, but he heard me out. Out of that developed, if you remember the movie Casablanca, a beautiful friendship. I became his impresario here in the United States and arranged for him to speak to virtually every American law school as he traveled about the country for honorary as little as $100 and occasionally maybe $1,000 or $2,000, which he accepted as a way of giving him the opportunity to spread the message of the ANC throughout the United States. And ultimately, Albie has told part of this story. When the end of apartheid came about, Albie was appointed to the Constitutional Court in South Africa, before which the Legal Resources Center brings many cases even today. So it's something about the interconnectedness of all of this, at least the interconnectedness of some of the good things about it as well as some of the bad things about it. I just thought I'd take this opportunity to tell about how we met Albie and became lifelong friends out of that experience.
Okay, thank you. I should say that David Hood also helped to arrange my own first trip to South Africa in 1979, which was when the Legal Resources Center started. He arranged for me, actually, to work with John Dugard at the Center for Applied Legal Studies at the University of Witwatersrand, which also started in the same year. So there's a little bit of common experience here. Let me open this up. While people are thinking what they might want to ask, Albie, I'd like to ask you about the South African Constitutional Court. It has played an enormously important role. But it has been, to some degree, under attack in South Africa. Do you feel that it is secure today, that its independence is going to be maintained in South Africa?
Last year was a very heavy year for us. We became litigants in a case based on a judge president of one of the high courts approaching two members of our court who were hearing an appeal involving a search and seizure operation against Jacob Zuma, who is now the president of South Africa. And he indicated fairly clearly to them that they should give judgment in favor of Jacob Zuma. And the court reported the matter to the Judicial Service Commission. I was working at the Ford Foundation at the time. When the information came through, I was stunned. We just don't do those things in South Africa. I might say when I spoke to some American legal friends, they said, oh, is that all? So maybe they're not quite as naive or pristine here in their views as we were. This particular judge president drummed up quite a lot of support, and he didn't feel restrained by any limits in terms of self-projection, his declared intention to become Chief Justice of South Africa being broadcast, attacks being made on his colleagues, that's those of us on the Constitutional Court, and we were all decent chaps and decent ladies. We just couldn't engage in that kind of thing. But all the public saw was the judges are fighting with each other. It was hemorrhaging. And the litigation went on and on and on, and eventually there was one case where the judgment had been totally in favor of the Constitutional Court, but this judge president said he wanted to exercise his final right of appeal to the highest court in the land on constitutional matters, the Constitutional Court. It just became bizarre. Appealing to the court that in effect was the litigant, and he was going to say there's a constitutional crisis in the country because the judges are litigants and they can't hear the matter and I'm being deprived of my right of appeal, and so on and so forth. In any event, the four of us, whose 15-year term, and we were the four last of what I call the Magnificent 11, the first 11, the last ones left standing, we had to leave. And there's a lot of excitement now. Who would replace us? And would this judge be appointed? And he was very confident, and he had his claques all over the country and people in the newspapers backing him. And many people thought it's a done deal. The pressure on the body that makes the selection, the Judicial Service Commission, sends up the names to the president, three more names and the number of positions to be filled. The president has to choose from that list. It's the opposite of the situation here, where the president nominates and the Senate has to approve. They heard him, but when it came to sending up the seven names, apparently his name wasn't even on the list of candidates to be considered to be one of the seven. So that fell away. If he had been appointed to the court, that could have been very, very serious. I'm just giving my own personal view now. There's some elements of toxicity in debate and argument that poison everything independently of the actual merits. It's a style and a character that just makes rational discussion and respectful and civil interaction impossible. And that would have been the real damage. He's not lacking in brains. He's smart. He understands the law. But there was something that was so contestationary and so ugly, it could have been a disaster. In any event, on the bright side, we hung together. I'm just speaking now as a former judge. My own view was that the court, the the sense of cohesion amongst the court was strengthened during that whole period. We weathered that whole particular storm. And we've got four replacements. Some are more experienced than others, but there's nothing that makes it look as though there's an attempt to take over the court being packed. And I think it's a strong court. We have our precedent. It's very, very clear, well established now. Above all, we have a style of work, possibly the most collegial court in the world. We will workshop, go round the table again and again and again. Even when a colleague writes a judgment that goes against your own judgment, we will strengthen that judgment just for the pride of the court. We want everything that comes out of the court to be rigorous and good and respected. So even if you strengthen the argument against your argument, we do it. And we do it wholeheartedly, because that's the character of the institution. Now, I'm known to be an optimist. One of the problems with being an optimist is if I'm sad about anything, people think that's the end of the world, even Albie. You know, even Albie. But I think sometimes they're strong grounds for optimism, sometimes they're middling grounds for optimism, sometimes the grounds for optimism don't exist, there's only optimism. And I would place my optimism between the first and the second at the top level of that. I think we've really established something that's got now strong roots in our society, in our culture, in the political culture of the country. The relationships with the executive are much better now than they've been for years. We discuss things. The courts were very keen to control the management of the courts, all the administrative decisions on about the functioning of the courts. That was fiercely resisted by the previous Ministry of Justice. Now they're saying, if you want to have it, if you want the headache, fine. There's no principle involved. The state doesn't want to control every detail about who you appoint and how you structure the functioning of the courts. A complete sea change in a very positive way in that respect. So there are a lot of very positive signs with regard to the independence of the judiciary being respected. In the end, of course, an enormous amount depends on the judges themselves. And if they are compliant, you don't need to be bullied and badgered. If they let go of the task given to them by the Constitution, then nobody gets arrested, nobody gets bullied, nobody gets pressurized. You voluntarily cede your independence. On the other hand, you don't want to be striking down everything government does just to show that you're independent. It's got to be balanced. It's got to be a conversation between the branches of government. It's always got to be ruled by the Constitution. It's hard to let go. I heard somebody in America speaking about another. You guys are very good at phrases that capture something. The founding parent syndrome. And we are the founding parents. And we think, you know, this marvelous institution we created, nobody else can do it as well as we can. And the first generation left, Arthur Chaskelson, a brilliant, extraordinary leader, he left, but we carried on. In some ways, with new experience, people more in touch with the communities out there, and our style being very warm and so on, less of the edgy, bright, brilliant lawyers of the late apartheid period, smart and witty and sharp and edgy and being a little bit rasping at times. We have less of that. And brilliant people, marvelous lawyers and thoughtful people. The style, I would say, improved over the years. The collegial way of doing things, it just got better and better and better. So I'm pretty hopeful.
Okay, so if we can bring, we take one in the back there.
Thank you very, very much for your presentation. Do I have to say my name, or it's not relevant? My name is Terry Ann Herlihy, and I actually was a person who was in charge of the South African Scholars Fund at my university, at my college. And it was one of those types of things where you raise your hand for it. And because I had a lot of fundraising background in my life, I thought that I'd be the person to do it. And it was kind of a daunting task because I am Caucasian and I was trying to bring in as many different groups into the mix as possible. And yes, I was able to, but it's sort of like, I think that different colleges and universities really need to have access to a kind of legal defense fund of their own, because when it came to certain things, like I wasn't able to be a part of the divestment movement because, you know, people were divesting from South Africa in terms of businesses. I wouldn't be a coordinator immediately. They'd just get rid of it because it was too political. And then it created a problem with the people who were very, very vocal about the divestment issue in order to create change, through peaceful means to create change within the regime. So anyway, I stayed on board, but there was hostility about that. And then I was trying to nurture someone who was, you know, a background that would be more pleasing to, I mean, we were giving funds to someone who is a black South African person originally. And then what happened is that they were more interested in creating some sort of a fundraising initiative that involved a slave auction than there were any initiatives that I did. And then afterwards, after this person who was an African American who took over, who was like a freshman, and I was like a senior, and she was given a lot of work to do in regards to this particular issue.
I think you're going to have to expedite this.
My thing is that they wanted to bring in a white South African to receive the funds for this particular fund because they were both from South Africa. And it just seems that the apartheid issue was about how black South Africans were not receiving some sort of compensation. I'm sorry to go on about this, but I've had my own trauma. And it seems that it is something that needs to be discussed.
Can we bring this to a head? We can't go on at great length.
The issue is defining an African citizen for, okay. I guess, educational funds.
Right.
South African.
Let me take a couple of questions.
Okay.
Thank you for that. I think I saw a hand.
Yes, one over here.
Stephen.
Hi, my name's Steve Illman. I teach at New York Law School, and I've had the good fortune to know Jack and Albie a long time. Albie, your character and that of the other magnificent 10, I guess, was a wonderful asset for that court, but as you just said, the character of Judge President Schlope was quite the reverse, would have been quite the reverse, which obviously says that there's some set of characters that are welcome and desirable and some that are not. And I wondered if you could say a little more about what the line is between what's to be desired and what's to be avoided, but also about one other thing, because in the nature of things, even 11 magnificent judges are human judges, thus not perfect, thus presumably in some way struggling with their own imperfections. So I wanted to ask you, what should a good judge do about his or her own imperfections?
Yeah, let's say one more question and then you can respond.
The focus so far has been on legal matters, constitutional matters, but there were also other ways of dealing with apartheid. Edwin Land was confronted with a situation where he was told that his agent in South Africa was not doing right, and he tried to operate a business in South Africa on more menschlich grounds, treating people equally with regard to race and so forth. Could you comment at all on Polaroid's activities in South Africa, or did you know anything about it?
Okay. Do you want to comment now, or do you want more questions?
Maybe some more questions.
Let's get some more questions. Okay.
Hello. My name is Regina Bain. My background is in theater and education, and I'm interested in what it felt like and what your process was like in healing from your time in solitary confinement, and how you were able to bring that healing to the work that you did as a judge.
Okay, and one more question.
Okay, thank you. I'm curious about the court and its makeup. There's four people. What are the decisions? Is there a unanimous decision? The second thing I'm curious about is any cases of racism have come up to you? And what have been the discussions? Anything that's been, what have been some of the elements that you've discussed and some of the decisions you've made, if any? And the third thing is, whatever happened to the doctor you were talking about?
Okay, so why don't you now try to respond as you...
Okay, if I can use my...
Sure.
Use your discretion. Judicial authority.
Yes. Now,
I think I saw a hand there. Very
okay,
eager.
All right.
No? No, it was somebody...
Over there?
With the glasses?
Okay.
No. Okay. Sorry. Okay. You're lucky.
Hi, I'm David Wildman. I'm with the United Methodist Board of Global Ministries. And I have a question of how you can help us today with manifestations of apartheid around the world. In 1976, the UN Convention on the Suppression and Punishment of Apartheid as a Crime Against Humanity came into force, and yet there are still many countries, I think almost all the former colonial powers, that have not signed on to that convention. So I'm wondering if you could say something about how could that convention that clearly draws on the disturbing realities and experiences of South Africa, but clearly intends to look at anywhere that apartheid practices are put into place. And the question I have is for us here in the United States is, in the global war on terrorism, there's, as you talked a lot in some of the examples of torture and other things that you shared, and I really appreciated your having the time to share with us today. There's an apartheid reality that certain practices, when they're imposed on bad guys, whoever defines that, are okay, and not okay when they're subjected to good guys. And so I'm wondering if you could just help us in the dynamics of apartheid, where they're not necessarily institutionalized in law the way they were in South Africa, but they are being practiced and accepted in racial profiling at airports, et cetera. So thank you.
Okay, we will stop now. Well, there were a bunch of questions that dealt with dilemmas in the period of the struggle against apartheid. And if you don't mind, I'm not going to deal with it now. We dealt with them at the time, and the divestment, and what people should do, and so on. And there were always many different dimensions. The fact is that what was remarkable in the end, it was racist South Africa's last reliable friend, namely the United States of America, turning away from giving that support, that precipitated the end as far as the apartheid people were concerned. Pik Botha, the foreign minister, said the hole was too big, we couldn't bail out the water anymore. When Citibank or whatever the bank was said, we're not rolling out funds anymore. When Ronald Reagan tried to use a veto against the anti-apartheid legislation, and that was overturned, that was really the writing on the wall, the last trusted friend. And it wasn't just that suddenly Capitol Hill, the people had moments of revelation and apartheid is so awful. It became a huge issue in this country, and people like yourselves were debating and taking stands and positions in all sorts of different ways, some helping individuals like you were doing over there, others taking part in campaigns in different ways, challenging. And it became an American issue because it became a moral question in this country. How can we support academic institutions that speak about freedom and openness and learning, that have money invested in a country where education is segregated, where people are denied their basic rights, isn't there a contradiction? And so these issues were made very, very, very alive, and it deserves to be memorialized. And I'm told some poor people going to see the soccer in 2010 in South Africa are going to be confronted with a film, a very well-made film about the American support for the struggle against apartheid. And I hope some of them, in between the big games, are actually sufficiently diverted to enjoy seeing that film. The court consists of 11. I like Magnificent 11 because it's like Magnificent 7. So we've got to think of another adjective for 10. Maybe before the end somebody can come up with a something 10. Or with four of us gone, it will be Magnificent 7, that's fine. Magnificent 7. I was asked to speak at a conference of prosecutors and magistrates, sort of not the high-flying elite of the legal judicial world. It was very interesting for me to go on just how they should envisage the future. And I felt there's so much emphasis on training and understanding working well. What about some of the intangibles? And I think that's the question that Stephen, in a way, is getting at. And I came up with the three C's. I remember there were three. Let's see if I can remember them. Civility. Civility to me is not just good manners. It is that, but it's much more than that. To me, civility, and the book actually refers to that, civility is part of democracy. It's respecting people who differ from yourself, with whom you differ, maybe even very, very sharply, but maintaining a framework within which you can debate and discuss of respect for the right of other people to have different views. And civility on the bench is particularly important amongst the judges themselves and between judges and counsel who are appearing, judges and witnesses and others. And it's not always to be found. I mean, we see films about, is it Justice Judy? But that's a different kind of a court. You know, that's a people's court that mixes it, and it's great. But if the Supreme Court were behaving like that, or let's say if all the judges of the Supreme Court were behaving like that, that would be awful. And then the one who shouts the loudest, who's got the sharpest voice and invective, would win out. So civility, and I'm trying to tell the magistrates that you owe a duty. As I say, it's not just good manners and propriety. You owe a duty to the citizens, to defendants, to counsel, to everybody, to maintain a degree of civility in the court. Okay, that's one C. Courage. I found this the hardest thing to convey. It's not the courage to... You're not called upon often to stand up and these are my thoughts, if I have to go down, so be it. A grand kind of position like that. It sometimes requires courage to disagree with your colleagues whom you love and respect and admire very much on just little aspects. I know this came through very sharply to me when one of my colleagues in a debate early on, we were all different people, different backgrounds, and now we're sitting together. And he said, I don't want to sound like an old woman. And I just reacted instinctively. I won't give the name away, but you know, why do you say old woman? And it is a nasty concept when you come to think of it. You don't want to sound like an old woman. Now, I blurted out my opposition. He was very upset. Maybe he saw that as a lack of civility on my part. But I feel there's some things you do take a stand on. They're little things, but they're inappropriate for... the Constitution speaks about non-sexism. It's in terms. The question of gender equality is spelled out in the Constitution. It's not just being ahead of the game. That is the game. I might say he went on to write a most beautiful judgment shortly afterwards. I call it a pro-feminist judgment. So in a way, that intervention was important, and I was pleased that I had responded. And I felt that was a moment of courage on my part, because it's inconvenient, it's embarrassing, but you just feel there are just some things you don't let them pass. And there are lots of little things like that. It's sometimes critiquing a colleague who has worked so hard on a judgment and has put everything into it, just not getting it right. Maybe somebody whose third language is English. It can be very tricky. You can be patronizing it. It can come through as you belong to that superior group because English has a hegemonic position. You are the smart ones and the others are somehow backward. And it rankles. Moments of judgment about how to not let something incorrect pass, but not to appear to be a schoolmaster or schoolmistress intervening. There are lots of little things like that where courage is required. And it's courage to be unpopular with people you love, not with people you don't like, who are threatening you, but with people you love. It's a hard thing to explain. And maybe you found it sometimes in academic settings, something like that. So this is what I was trying to convey to the magistrates. The courage is that integrity, that belief in the constitutional, the judicial project, its adherence to that. That's what the courage aspect is. And it's not beating up and coming up with defiant statements. It might, in certain circumstances, involve that. Drag me off to jail, if you like. But that's not really where you need courage. And the third is collegiality. And I think collegiality is an absolutely fundamental quality of a good judge. And the trick there is you've got to follow your own conscience. Sometimes it's terribly lonely. You can't understand. 10 clever people whom you respect and admire, they just don't get it. Can I be the only one who's right? And yet you're convinced that you are right. So on the one hand, you have to be totally independent and willing to go against the stream. On the other hand, you have to engage with colleagues and discuss and debate in a rational sort of a way. So I would say these are three exceptionally important, intangible qualities. One assumes that you've got a certain technical skill and capacity, that you listen properly to the arguments, that you weigh up and so on. These are kind of givens. But the other qualities, I would say, would be those. We sit 11 in all cases. A quorum is 8. If it's less than 8, it's not a court. And it doesn't have any decision we take. It doesn't have any binding authority at all. And occasionally you get a tie. And there's no casting vote. And it only happened in one case where 10 of us sat. We split 5-5. And there are two theories that operated. The one is that you're hearing an appeal. If there isn't a majority for the appeal, then the appeal fails. The other theory is there's a presumption of constitutionality. And if there isn't a majority to say that the measure is unconstitutional, the measure stands. It so happened in that particular case that both these theories pointed in the same direction. And so the decision of the High Court stood. But that's happened once in 15 years. We had one case where we didn't have more than 3 people agreeing on any particular outcome. And it would have been really pathetic. And we maneuvered and found we could get agreement. The problem was on the order, not on the basic principles. And in the end, somebody had to budge. And it was either Yvonne Mokgoro, who's sweet and gentle and lovely and warm, embracing person, and Albie Sachs, whom you're listening to now, who's obstinate and dogged and digs in his heels, and once he's made up his mind, doesn't change very easily. Well, Albie Sachs was the one who broke. And we got the majority. Nobody knows it. When I had to look at the judgment, my judgment recently, there were certain kinks in it. A powerful argument leading to a very feeble conclusion. Only I noticed it. It didn't make any difference to our jurisprudence. Have I covered? I'd just like to say a bit about the healing. What happened to the doctor? The case was sent back for trial in the High Court, and the prosecution decided 10 years had passed. They were having problems getting evidence. Some evidence had already been led. Some people had renounced the evidence they'd given, and that it wasn't worthwhile proceeding. What was important for us is we'd established the principle that you had to pay account in deciding whether or not to chuck out proceedings to the balancing out all the different interests involved and the importance of the weight to be given to atrocious crimes, and these were war crimes. It was the first time our court had dealt with the importance of war crimes in South Africa in our judgment. So we established the principles. He walked free. He's still walking around. He's a cardiologist. And about 5 months ago, I get onto the plane, South African Airways flying to Europe, and I see, walking onto the plane, just behind me, Dr. Besson. He sees me, he gives a kind of half smile, yeah, nervous, I see him. We land in Zurich. I think, well, now that's over, I'm flying to Amsterdam. And I get on the plane to Amsterdam, and there's Dr. Besson on the plane. I think we're both a bit paranoid now. I think, well, I'm going to avoid him at least at the carousel. And even there, for the last time, our suitcases were right next to each other. So there you are. He's walking freely. But for me, the point is, it's more important that we operate the principles of the rule of law, the right to a fair trial. That's what really matters. That's what we were fighting for. And that brings in the healing aspect. We do have counseling, psychotherapy for victims of torture and others. But to me, the massive healing takes place through the transformation of the country. The things that hurt, if they continue to hurt, as William Faulkner said, the problem with the past is that it isn't past. If it carries on into the future, if it continues to rankle and hurt, you can't heal very much. But if people actually see that there are real changes, and certainly for those of us who are directly in the struggle, who are maimed in the struggle, if we see outcomes, what I wrote in the Soft Vengeance, the Freedom Fight, and I wrote it spontaneously, if the man who was caught in Maputo, and if he's put on trial for putting the bomb in my car, and the evidence is insufficient to convict him, and he is acquitted, I said, that will be my soft vengeance. Because that would mean we're living under the rule of law, which is much more important than sending one rascal to jail. And I said, if we get democracy in South Africa and votes for everybody and freedom and a new constitution, I said, roses and lilies will grow out of my arm. The last time I looked, I didn't see any roses and lilies. But in terms of my own healing, and even the healing that I had as the divisions as a student, hearing these beautiful words up on the campus, writing them to pass the exams, and then going into a township with candle lights and speaking to people who had 3 or 4 years schooling, who knew nothing about words like the rule of law and justice and equity, willing to give their lives for justice. And you just, by candlelight, you just see the eyes and the mouths. It's so expressive. And I felt no connection between the two. I felt the two were at war with each other. The people living in the shanties hated the law. The law was the knock on the door. It was the policeman harassing you. It was being thrown into jail. And only when we came to write the Constitution, the beautiful phrases of the ages met up with the hopes and expectations of the poor and the dispossessed. And that was very healing for me, psychically, for me, Albie. And then to be able to sit on the court and to be able to work constructively. Some people in the struggle never got beyond being against. And they're terrific. They're still around and they're still against everything and demanding and criticizing. And we need them. Every society needs them. But some of us were longing, were aching to build, not just to put down, not just to critique. And that's very healing. So I think one needs intensive support for individuals who are psychologically very scarred, and that can take many different forms. But when you're dealing with collective pain that's shared on an enormous basis, you need major social transformations. And I think that's it.
I think we ought to end on that note. I think that in talking about healing, you illustrated about as well as possible the theme of your book and how your life experiences shaped your role as a judge. So I think that's the right place to thank you for taking part in this discussion. Thank you, Jack. Thank you very much.
I might be outside signing.